Blog Talk Radio.
Pull.
Whether you're new on the range or a longtime sportsman, you'll find great deals on guns, ammo, equipment, and more this week at Cabela's. Save big on all your favorite brands like Winchester, Benelli, Hornaday, and more. Get 20% off all Walker's hearing protection and $400 off of Cabela's Signature 64 Safe. Plus, join us for free safety education, training, demos, and seminars because responsible ownership starts at Cabela's. Stop in and save all week at Cabela's and remember to own responsibly.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and we have with us today Coach Bill Patton. And I say Coach Bill Patton, but he is also author Bill Patton, entrepreneur Bill Patton, clothing designer Bill Patton. He's got lots of hats that he wears. And I'm really excited to have him back on the show to talk about his latest book and also his latest ventures. And I think we're going to have a great conversation today about a lot of different topics that are applicable to parents of junior players and also to coaches of junior players. So I hope you enjoy today's show. Bill's latest book, Vision Training in Tennis, Going Beyond Watch the Ball, is really very interesting and kind of groundbreaking. And so I'm excited to have him on to talk about that. But like I said, also to share some other things that he's involved in and to have him back on the show. So without further ado, let me bring Bill on the air and we can jump right into this conversation. Bill, good morning. Thank you for joining us. It's early on your side of the country, but I appreciate you spending time with us today.
Hi, Lisa. Yeah, it's an honor to be on the show. Thank you very much.
Well, I always love having you on because we always have very interesting conversations, and I always learn something new from you. And so I'm going to just let us jump right in because I know you, and I know you can fill up an hour quicker than anybody with information and useful stuff. So I don't want to dilly-dally too much. Let's jump into this new book on vision training, and I'd love to hear what inspired you to start the research on that and what you learned and the information that you're willing to share with the rest of us.
Okay. Well, you know, let me first start with a couple of items on that. One is that I thought I knew a lot about vision when I started the book, and then I really felt like I should really get into the scientific research, as you know, in the journals of sports psychology and in exercise, you know, physiology and other, you know, physical education realm stuff. And then some friends also recommended some things that I should watch on public television in regard to the brain and the interaction with vision. And honestly, I think I learned over 50% of what's in the book doing the research, and I was really blown away by how much I didn't know. If you want, we can take a really quick quiz, and I think that in a moment, and we'll I think you'll discover something very interesting that I did not know going into it. And then a funny thing happened. I'd written the book, and I was planning to actually write a second edition because I'd realized I had left some things out. So I was driving home from Los Angeles late at night, and I was seeing dark shapes going across the freeway. And I thought, you know, what is that? And I was scared that I was going to hit something, and then there were some other strange visual effects that I was seeing late at night, so I'd had to stop and rest my eyes quite often. I was very concerned about my vision, and I thought, you know, do I have a torn retina? Do I have a problem with this because of so many hours in the sun? And then it turns out that I just need glasses. So
welcome to my world.
No, but it was really funny, and I've never actually thought I would be excited about having glasses, but now that I know what high-definition TV looks like, it's an exciting new world. So
yeah.
So that's, you know, that's kind of the fun stuff of the introduction of that. But no, you know, it's interesting because a lot of times when I will talk to my students, one of the first questions I ask them is, what's your most important body part when it comes to playing tennis? You know, and they'll guess, oh, your arm, your feet, you're this, you're that. And I'm like, well, no, it's your eyes. Because vision of the ball is really the most important thing. Because it's the seeing and the training of reacting to the ball quickly that is such a huge factor in the dividing line between bad players and good players and great players. As an example of that, I was just at the Nordic Naturals Challenger on Saturday with some players, and we saw players in the top 300 to 500 playing, and it was dramatic, the difference in the reaction time to the ball from these players who are, you know, outside of the top 300 to players who are well inside the top 100. So
you could see that, because, I mean, it's so interesting. I was just having this conversation with someone at the BB&T Atlanta Open about how small the margins are in the professional game. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if you look at stroke production, movement, fitness, all those things among, you know, if you look at Djokovic versus, let's say, a 300-ranked player, the margins are just minuscule. So you're saying one of the things where you really are seeing a margin is in reaction time. That's so interesting.
Oh, it's huge. And as you progress as a coach or a player, then the attention to minutia becomes such a huge part of the training, because you're looking for that, you know, little tiny edge that you can get. Here's another interesting thing, and so it's great that you brought up Djokovic, because here's a piece from the book that relates to Djokovic, and if anybody who's watched him for more than a couple of hours will recognize this, that you'll see him quite often preparing to return serve, and he will open his eyes incredibly wide open, right?
Yep.
And he'll do that periodically, and my personal theory is that he's preparing himself not to blink, because people blink on average 22 times in a minute. And I think if many people just simply paid attention to their blinking and learned to have their eyes open longer while they're playing a point, they would miss fewer shots.
Interesting.
And, you know, how many errors in a set happen because a player blinked at the wrong time and then just didn't see the ball as well as they could have?
Are there stats on that?
On how the errors are caused?
But, well, no.
The average is 22 times in a minute.
Well, no. I'm saying the blinking causing the unforced error. That's fascinating to me.
Well, it seems to me that if your eyes are closed at the moment that the ball comes off the opponent's racket, or as it's crossing the net, or as it's hitting the ground on your side, then missing any one of those three moments could lead to a problem. So,
sure.
You know, it would stand to reason that players who can blink less or not at all for, you know, the period of time that the ball is traveling towards them would have an advantage over those who can't.
And are you saying that this is something that can be trained?
I believe it can. I think really it comes down to mindfulness. So, if there are people out there who are skeptical, I would say give it a shot. And, you know, I can relate to that opening the eyes wide open. I somewhere down the line, I had a coach who had told me that that he felt like I was blinking too much and that I should, you know, I should do something to really pay close attention to that.
Interesting.
So it's just one example.
Yeah. Well, so as a coach, I mean, you work with juniors. As a coach, how would you help somebody correct that?
We talk about it. Basically, now that's a great question because I think there's more to it. One thing that I discovered in the book, in the research, was that no two people's experience of vision is the same. And there are incredible outliers of people who have very bizarre visual experiences where if they see a certain number or a word, then they will experience colors in their mind. And there are other people who will see an object and they will hear music. And it's really fascinating. And then here's another factor, and here's where we'll get to the quiz, all right? What percentage of your visual experience has to do with the stimuli coming through your eyes right now? Take a percentage guess.
Okay, wait, say that again, because my brain didn't even process the question.
That's okay, it's early. Well, it's early for me. You don't have an excuse.
Yeah,
right?
I have no excuse.
Okay.
Sorry.
What percentage of your visual experience, okay, is coming through your eyes right now?
I mean, I would say 99%.
That's what people assume, that your whole
right.
visual experience is coming through the sensory input of your eyes at this moment. It's actually about one third.
Really?
And here's why. Because your brain has already stored a lot of the information about your environment that you're in right now. So the location of the furniture, you know, where the light switch is, and the pairing of the tactical experience with your visual experience is a huge part of that. This kind of relates to the so-called inner game of tennis, you know, where Galway says, oh no, it's a backhand, so it's coming to my backhand. So then the player flashes through their whole mental catalog of all the horrible backhands they've hit in their life. And so then balls coming to their backhand inspire fear, or high backhands or low backhands or whatever it is, that the visual experience is like that. So, you know, consider you wake up in the middle of the night and you know where to put your feet and you can make it to the bathroom, but contrast that with how hard you work visually if you wake up at a hotel room or if you're at, you know, you're a guest at someone's house and you don't know tactically where things are, then your visual experience is really challenged because you have to find things.
Right. No, I get it. My husband is one of those guys who can't see squat without his glasses in and, you know, has to make sure there's always a clear path to the bathroom for those middle of the night.
There you go.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
You know, another interesting thing here is that, you know, there's a debate about how soon do you need to start playing tennis, how early do you need to start, you know, do you need to specialize early? And I think there's a case for the fact that it is incredibly beneficial to at least start playing tennis at a very early age because it's one of the most visually demanding sports that there is. You know, when it comes to, you know, hitting 145 to 150 mile an hour serves back, maybe, if you can see it. You know, and just all the wide variety of things that happen because you have to read and react to the ball. So there was one of the things that was very compelling was a story about a man who had lost his sight at the age of, I think it was 4, And then 40 years later, with the use of stem cell treatment, he received back the 100% full function of his eyes.
Wow.
But the thing that was missing was the 36 years of experience or whatever it was, you know. So lengthy. So on the way home from the hospital, they're driving home, and every time they drive under a road marker, the overhanging road markers, he would duck. He felt like they were going to hit him in the forehead. 10 years later, he still couldn't recognize his children. So it points out that these visual experiences of the ball, as we're young and we're growing and all that, you know, the time on task does make a difference. So I wouldn't argue that you have to be an early specialization player, because I think now we see, you know, Sam Querrey and Steve Johnson, you know, are two players who did not specialize incredibly early, and they're doing quite well.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. So can we build those experiences in our brain through playing other sports or other activities and still have them be applicable to our tennis skill on the court? In other words, you know, if you're playing baseball, a ball's coming at you as you're batting. So would that, you know, imprint similar experiences on the brain as returning a serve, or, you know, playing soccer and your footwork and, you know, moving and depth perception and all of those things, would those experiences cross over to tennis for those kids who, I think we all agree now, the research supports not specializing early. So, you know,
yeah. But
for a kid that looks to specialize in tennis by age 13, 14, would playing all those other sports create those same memories, you know, that would help them to see the ball better?
You know, I think that one of the cool things about this book is that there's nothing conclusive. So it's 28 essays on vision, and then people can glean from it what they will. I'd be hard pressed to say that there's any concrete answer that fits with everyone. So, don't accept the answer of someone who says that it always must be this way. But it stands to reason. I mean, I'm a big fan of playing multiple sports for a lot of different reasons. One, running on grass is a lot better for you than running on a hard court. Also, when you get the exposure to lots of different strategies, lots of different ways that balls move through the air, lots of different, you know, strange little situations. Like, you know, one of the things they don't often talk about is, you know, they like to talk about how, oh, all of the top 10 players played on clay. Okay, wonderful. But what they don't talk about is the large number of players in the top 100 or top 10 that played soccer, which is a really big number. And so, you know, I have a number of soccer players at the high school that I coach that also come out for tennis, and I pitch them to say, your ability to react to the soccer ball is going to be much better having played tennis because it moves a lot faster. So the soccer ball is just going to seem like it's taking an eternity to get there now.
Right.
So, yes, the sum total of all these experiences and the ability to, you know, quickly move your body that way to you know, react to a soccer ball that's 2 feet away and just got kicked at a different angle, and now you have to instantaneously react. I think that's going to help you when you're dealing with somebody just hit you, you know, 100 mile an hour forehand. You know, and these these things are happening more and more. I mean, players are hitting the ball, you know, 80 and 90 miles an hour fairly routinely, and then every once in a while you get these shots that are 100. James Blake hit 122 mile an hour forehand.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Can't imagine being across the net from that.
So the amount of time, once you know how to, here's one thing that I think is a general truth, and, you know, anybody wants to discuss this with me, I would love it, you know, is that once you know how to stroke the ball and have sort of some fundamentals of movement, everything else is about learning to save time.
Okay.
Because time is the big issue. People are taking time away from one another, and that's how you win a tennis match at the highest levels.
Mhm. Yeah, no, I agree, and I mean that's why we're constantly hearing, you know, the commentators saying that the person returning serve needs to step up into the court. We're seeing those stats of court position because all of that takes time away, right? The further into the court you are, the less time the person on the opposite side of the court has to return your ball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, yeah, and then you find that, you know, the players, the top players have strokes and have movement that gives them time. And they can either give or take away time. And sometimes they'll actually give another player so much time that they have too much time to think about their shot. And then because of the high-pressure situation, then they'll miss. So, mm-hmm. the book is about it's a lot of different things. It's about the combination between how do your eyes work with your brain, how does the tactile experience come into it, and what are some strategies to train your eyes to think about your vision, to, you know, there are different exercises like that, and some of the exercises I gleaned from the book Inner Tennis, Playing the Game, which is the second book by Tim Galway that people don't really know about very well. So, you know, I got a few exercises from that book, and there are more out there. Here's one that people can try today, and it will probably help them return serve better. You can do this now in the studio there, Lisa. If you put your finger about 6 to 8 inches from your face and then focus on your fingerprint, right? Then
okay.
Everything else looks double vision, right?
Yes.
In the background?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep,
and then if you focus
yep.
on, now you focus on the wall until you can see a pattern there, and you can really see the detail of something on the far wall. Now your finger is double vision in front of you.
Yep.
But if you go on a tennis court, you can focus on the cyclone fence until you see that pattern, then bring your vision back to your finger and then back to the fence and then finger, fence, finger, fence. And you can actually shift your focus at approximately 120 miles an hour.
Wow.
And so that exercising of the eyes to be able to have the shifting focus that comes with the ball can really make a huge difference. So that's one, that's a little freebie for you right there, but that's just one exercise. And then there are a lot of other ball awareness exercises in that book. So.
Very cool.
And it comes in an ebook and then also a little print book. So it's not a big item, and you know, I'm still kind of gathering some more information, so there may be a third edition coming in the next 6 months or so. But you know, as I gain more information on that, then I will be updating it so that people can revisit it as well.
Awesome. So if somebody wants to pick up a copy of your book, we'll have a link on the books page of parentingaces.com, but they can also find it on Amazon and anywhere else, Bill?
That's pretty much it. Just go to
okay.
Amazon. I don't want to
okay.
buy a bunch of them and have them in my garage.
I don't blame you. Definitely don't blame you. You guys,
go to the post.
If you go to parentingaces.com, you'll see the book available there, and hopefully you'll pick up a copy and learn something new. I think it's just it's very fascinating. So I'm looking forward to learning more myself. To help my own tennis. So this provides a great opportunity to segue, Bill, into our next topic of conversation. And when you and I were talking before we started the show, we were talking about the issue of cheating in junior tennis. And I know you have very strong thoughts on that and what needs to happen. And so I'm going to just let you segue into that topic.
Okay. You know, it's funny. I think it's funny that people often say to me that I have strong thoughts, and I guess I like it, but I like to think that I have right thoughts.
I don't think strong implies wrong. I think strong just implies that you've put a lot of energy into thinking about the issue and have formulated some ideas, and I think it's a good thing.
All right. So here's what we'll start with. And this is going to be kind of bizarre, but hopefully this little snippet draws people out of their preconceived notions or whatnot. But I love the movie Apocalypse Now because it's an incredible study of leadership and you know, well-placed and poorly placed loyalty. So Marlon Brando, who, you know, got paid handsomely and then did not follow the script, has some incredible lines in there. And he talks about, he uses the phrase moral courage. And then he gives a gruesome example of the things that the Viet Cong would do to make sure that their people were loyal to them. And I'm not going to get into all the details of that. If you know the movie, then you know what I'm talking about. But he admires the quote, the moral courage. And so if we take that out of that context and we just go, all right, what do we need? We need moral courage. And so what do we want the loyalty to? We want the loyalty to the game and the protection of the game and the integrity of it. And we kind of have to be willing to go to have some what many people would say is, I think, extreme behavior. I mean, I think, you know, so many people are careful not to be seen as, quote, judgmental or something along those lines, that they let pass these opportunities to show courage. So people will just sort of stand by while a player makes horrific calls or, you know, is completely out of control mentally and emotionally or abusive or what have you. They just stand by and they watch. So, you know, part of my upbringing was that, you know, I made a decision in my mind that I was never going to stand by and watch these things happen. So one of the examples of that is that in running USTA tournaments myself, I made my mind up that our tournaments that we ran were going to be run very well, and they would be, the people that won our tournament would be playing fair, because the people that were cheating would face resistance from the event. I mean,
specifically,
it doesn't make
how?
Okay, so for instance, probably the best thing I did was that I hired my juniors to be court monitors at our event. So I have 15 to 17-year-old kids on the court, and they're responsible to watch two or three or four courts. And then what they do is I instruct them to do the following. If they see a bad call or any kind of, you know, malfeasance on the court, then they all have walkie-talkies, and they let me know immediately. So as the referee, I come over, and I'm immediately at that court. So now what's the message that cheating player, if the player who made a bad call, has received? Is that shortly after they make a call, the referee will be watching their match. And that alone is so powerful. Then the other thing I give the players permission to do is is using their best judgment, if they've seen multiple bad calls, after the second call, they feel like the other kid's just not playing fairly, they have permission to lock gaze with that player, to use sort of a positive peer pressure on them. And it's really amazing. It's really amazing how when a 13-year-old makes a bad call, and then they look up and they see a 16-year-old that saw it, they will feel a sense of shame at that moment. And then we find that really eliminates a lot of it right there. And no one even had to be penalized.
Well, how are the parents reacting to this? I'm just curious.
Well, the parents have no idea what's happening because there's no negative outcome. There's nothing that's happening on the court that's bad. We just simply have people watching, you know, and then we have designated watchers, you know, and then because the kids know they're being watched, then they don't make bad calls. And they also know, they also begin to figure out that we don't hesitate getting lines people out there, and we will leave them on the court for the entire match. I think the USTA has made a grave error when they presumed that if an official came to the court for two games, that somehow that was going to curtail all future bad calls, because now that it's well known that they'll be leaving soon, then the cheating player knows, oh, I have to hold off on making some bad calls until they leave. So, you know, I mean, yeah, the phrase I heard was, let the kids play the match. I'm like, no, you really have to protect the good kids. And you don't know how many times I've heard from parents, thank you, thank you, thank you for running, you know, the tournament like this. You don't know how good it felt to know that the player that won it played fair and won it fairly.
It's so interesting because, you know, even in adult tennis, you know, league tennis or I don't play tournaments myself, but I've heard this goes on in adult tournaments as well. And I'm not talking about professional. I'm talking about purely recreational. The bad calls exist. And it's interesting to me to hear people discuss how they feel about the game after they've played multiple opponents who don't play by the rules. And it really causes such negativity toward the game of tennis. And I mean, I've talked to, I don't even know now how many parents who have said, you know, we're not doing this tournament thing anymore. We're done. The matches aren't played fairly. It's, you know, it's not worth the stress and aggravation. It costs too much and time and money to be at these events. And then to have your kid get cheated is, you know, it's just not, we're not doing it anymore. And
it's
a terrible statement on our sport.
This is where I really want to challenge people, all right? Here's what I say to those people. Cry me a river, you know? It's like, okay, if you're really feeling like that and you really care about the game, do something. Don't quit. right? Quitters never win. Winners never quit. Don't quit. Fight the battle. You know, I mean, see, this is where we have the society where we're so against conflict. You know, we don't want to be the complainers. We don't want to fight for what's right. And so then what happens? The bullies take over. I mean, you really, every once in a while, you have to punch the bully. And, okay, so there's a funny thing that happened.
Not literally.
Not literally. Thank you. Well, I mean, I've done that in my life before, but, you know, not in tennis.
Right.
So, you know, so here's an interesting thing. So I began to look at the draws of the corresponding tournaments that were, you know, not my tournament, and I saw how all these kids that had made bad calls were now attending all the other tournaments. And I thought, wow, that's great. That's somebody else's problem now. Wonder how they're going to deal with it. So I was very happy that we became known as the tournament that was played fairly. Now, let's say, okay, so let's say, I hear one of the things in the book, How to End Cheating in Junior Tennis, is to write a letter. You know, people don't give the USTA enough credit, though, because when the USTA is armed with a concise letter that focuses only on the problem at hand, then they really are empowered to deal with it. And they also, and if you don't believe that they're willing to deal with it necessarily, well, then at least you've started a paper trail.
Mm-hmm.
My experience in talking with my local section is, hey, you know, I'm getting all these complaints, blah, 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 and their response is always, well, can they put it in writing? Because you know, they can't respond to all these verbal complaints. They need somebody to sign their name on the bottom and say, this is what happened. You know, there were 12 bad calls in the match. It completely changed the complexion of it. My son feels like, you know, quitting tennis now. Something needs to be done.
Let me ask you this, Bill. Let me ask you this. In your experience in dealing, and let me just point out, you're in the Northern California section.
Yeah.
In your experience dealing with your section, does USTA want the letter to come from the parent or the player? Or does it matter?
Well, I can speak for me. I would have even greater empathy when the letter came from the kid, but
mm-hmm.
I would accept the, depending on the maturity level of the kid, I wouldn't mind ever getting a letter from a parent. So no, I don't think that's an issue so much, but I would encourage, kids who can write that letter to write that letter, because it's just it's probably 50 to 100% more powerful when it comes across
mm-hmm.
that way. In one of the main quotes, the beginning quote of the book, comes from Bill Mountford, you know, and they're saying that, you know, extremely large percentage of kids never play a second tournament. Because, you know, and a large percentage of kids are having such horrible experiences at tournaments that they're quitting, and we're losing this huge base of kids that are good, high-integrity kids that don't want to cause problems. They just want to go play another sport where there's an official who's presumably non-biased, or, you know, the mistakes will even out over the end of their life. They much rather play something else where their opponent can't steal the match from them. So, I mean, that's where I'm a big fan of supporting the silent majority. We often kowtow to these bully people because we are afraid of the conflict. Here's another interesting moment. I had a parent that was placing a camera in the view of the opponent, and then when the opponent was looking towards him while they were preparing to serve, he would move the camera to different locations, and it was a after watching it for a while, it didn't take long for me to figure out that this was gamesmanship, that he was creating a visual distraction for them.
Oh, my goodness.
So I asked him if he would please, leave the camera in one place, because of the visual distraction, and he began to shout at me. Mm-hmm. And then he called me a racist, and I don't even know really what his background is. So now he's shouting at me, and he's calling me a racist. Now, I think there are a lot of people that would just stop at that point because they don't want to be shouted at. So then, if I don't continue to deal with the situation, then I'm going to let him distract the other player. Sorry, that's not part of my makeup. So I asked him, now, sir, did you call me a racist because I'm white?
And what was the response?
I didn't really have an answer for that. I'm saying, it's because if that's true, sir, then that would mean that that's what you are.
So how did this get resolved?
I ended up having to, he refused to stop shouting at me. So then at that point, then I had to warn him that his player was going to get a code violation.
Let's clarify the rule is with USTA, if the parent misbehaves, the child of that parent coded.
Yes.
So everybody's clear on the rule.
Exactly. So the kid got warning, point, game, and I'm not up on things these days. Is it still four or is it three again? I don't know. But it was point, it was warning, point, game, and one more, and she was going to be defaulted. And then he finally left, after creating this huge problem. Well, then later what happened is he was suspended for 6 months and not allowed to come to his daughter's matches. And I say, great, I'm really happy that that happened because the section, I wrote up my thing and I was very factual. I said, he said this, I said that, he said this, and there was no additional interpretation added. So when you write these letters, you can't say, oh, and they didn't have ice and they weren't very friendly and, blah, 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 blah. You can't throw in a laundry list of complaints. You just need to be very factual of these are the events that transpired, period. And then that really empowers your local youth USTA section to follow up on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, even if you don't get the resolution, the justice that you want in that particular case, you've begun the process. You've shown, if they get another one with that parent, now something's going to happen. If they get another complaint about a certain kid. So remember the comedian Gallagher?
Yeah.
Remember that guy? Yeah. He had
the
thing
watermelon
where he
smasher.
Everybody should have a rubber sticky arrow guns, and you could shoot it at people's car, and then when somebody has three of those, then they get a ticket. It can be like that. So fighting one battle per year is really an important thing. Another thing that isn't done enough is celebrating sportsmanship. When you and your kid, encounter a really friendly family, and another kid who plays really well, make a big deal out of it. I mean, I would give effusive praise to an opponent that showed incredible sportsmanship so that not to put on a huge show, but just enough that the people in the area that are around could overhear your conversation saying, wow, you are a great sport. We really appreciate that. Win or lose, there were a couple of really close balls you could have called out, but you called them in, that's huge. That's really a major thing.
Go ahead.
Well, okay. I think we're kind of running out of time here, but I do want to share one story really quick. Because another thing that happens is we demonize juniors when really what we need to do is teach them. So, the Eastern European family, pretty sure they were from Bosnia, and the kid was making bad calls, and I was watching the match, and I was watching the kid very carefully, and he seemed to have no guile. I mean, he didn't look like a cheater to me. I mean, he just seemed like a nice kid, but he was blowing these calls, right? So I was like, this doesn't add up. So the opponent's getting all mad, but they never call for a lines person, and we don't insert ourselves in the situation. They still have to make that call. So anyway, but after the match is over, and I bring the dad over, and I bring the son over, and I tell the dad, because I'm watching the dad, and the dad looks very uncomfortable because he thinks his son's making bad calls. So I'm like, squirmy dad feeling ashamed, and a nice kid who's making bad calls, but he doesn't seem to be a cheater. What's going on here? So I'm like, what's going on? So I get them together and I say, sir, you know what? I really like your son here, and I think we both saw that there were some calls that were not the best. Can you take your son to the eye doctor?
So
a couple months later, so they were like kind of shocked that I would do that. And then a couple months later, the dad comes running up to me, and I'm like, uh-oh, what's he going to do? Is he going to slug me? Right? And he comes running up, and he says, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. You know, we took my son to the doctor, and, yeah, his vision was off, and now he's playing great.
That's awesome.
So, but see, we're so quick to judge a kid, and we don't even know if they have a vision problem.
Well, but Bill, I think you'll agree from having been around junior tournaments probably way more than I have that there are situations where kids develop that reputation as being cheaters. And, you know, I know with my kid, you know, we'd be at a tournament and there'd be kids in the draw we didn't know. Maybe we're in a new section or new city or whatever, and inevitably somebody would come up to him and say, oh, you're playing so and so, you better watch his call. You know, so it gets in your head before you even set foot on the court that I better be careful, this kid makes bad calls. Why kids shouldn't have to deal with that? They've got enough to deal with when they step foot on the court to compete, you know, without having to worry about whether the guy on the other side of the net is playing fairly. And I think, you know, that in and of itself.
Well, here's the problem. Here's the problem. No one ever created a large enough conflict where that kid would have to deal with their bad calls. There was no letter written. No one ever said to the other kid, hey, you're making bad calls and that stinks. You need to knock that off. I mean, something has to happen there. We just let those kids go on and continue to be a train wreck. Why do we do that?
I'm not sure you're correct about that, because I know specifically in our section of kids that did have letters written about them numerous times who were allowed to continue to play. So it's not always that case.
In that case, that case needs to be taken to a higher court. So if it didn't get dealt with by the junior supervisory group, then you have to go to the group that oversees them. And you have to keep going up the ladder until you get satisfaction. And then maybe it becomes a thing where you write the letter about the malfeasance of the organization that is responsible for overseeing this stuff and deal with that way. So, I mean, sometimes the battle becomes a lot bigger, and you have to be ready to fight it. I got a review on my book that said this stuff doesn't work, and it was from South Florida, and I'm like, okay, well that's sad, but no, the funny thing is, I'm firmly believe that all the stuff in the book works. Not every strategy is for everyone, but they just need to be applied by more people and by more committed people. And then, you know, and then we'll start to see more change. You know, among the three major organizations that have a huge influence in tennis, I found that the PTR has been very, very good about helping to promote this particular topic, but I'm actually somewhat disappointed by the other two large organizations that I won't name. And yet, you know, each of those organizations was present at the tennis summit talking about this problem, and their panel discussion in Indian Wells was the impetus for the writing of this book. And yet then when I turned around and I said, okay, this book is ready and I want you to look at it, will you please look at it and review it? Then I got crickets. So, you know, to some extent, you know, the fight has to be taken higher and higher until everyone realizes how serious it is for us to make a commitment on that.
Well, there are those who argue that, so your kid gets cheated. Too bad. They better learn how to deal with it. Life isn't fair. Tennis is a microcosm of life at large. This is a great place to learn how to deal with those types of inequities that exist in the world. And I agree with that to a point. I do. But the flip side of it is, you know, this is sport. Sport is supposed to be fair. And we need to do everything in our power to ensure that it stays fair.
You know, what you're talking about is a crisis of character because the cheating goes on. So the people that are allowed to cheat in sports then carry that behavior forward into their professional lives, and then we have, you know, white collar crime.
No, I hear you.
I say absolutely not. Teach those kids to play fair and teach them those ethics, and they will carry them forward into the rest of their lives. But see, yeah, this is what we're up against. We're up against the group, the dark forces that say, if you're not cheating, you're not trying hard enough. That's what we're up against. And it's like ISIS, you know. I mean, it's gonna take a fight. You know, you're not gonna, you know, wave white flags at them.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's a tough call, and to those who think that when your kid gets to college tennis that things are way better, I will tell you that's not always the case. The same kids that cheated in the juniors find a way to do it in college if they're not helped, as Bill suggests. And, then they take it out onto the pro tour too. And, you know, at the entry levels of our sport, there are no people on the court policing these things. There aren't lines people at every match. There aren't chair umpires at every match. So we really, our sport, unlike any other, relies almost 100% on the integrity of the participants. And
right.
I love your idea of teaching these kids who are making bad calls not to make the bad calls. I love that. But that takes a huge commitment on the part of our governing body, on the part of the tournament officials, on the part of all of us parents who are out there. We all have to work together to put a stop to it and stop saying that this is just a part of our sport. It doesn't need to be a part of our sport, and it shouldn't be a part of our sport.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a phrase I like that I picked up from a friend, and he says, that's not okay. Not around me, not around here. And, you know, We don't need the USTA to all of a sudden change its way I mean, I think we need to empower the USTA. So anyone listening to this, your sphere of influence is that tournament you're going to be at this weekend. And if you see some really heinous example of incredibly bad sportsmanship and you write a letter on that, it will have an impact. And if we, and if these really, these gross problems are tackled, then it really, it sends a message to everyone else. You know, I had an example of a player who threw his racket harder than I've ever seen someone throw his racket before, and it was after match point, but I defaulted him anyway. And so then that meant he also was defaulted from the tournament, and that disappointed his doubles partner. And the doubles partner comes to me and says, "Hey, do you realize you just defaulted your number one seed?" As though, you know, somehow I was going to lose prestige at my tournament. You know, and I thought, wow, that's really off the mark. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm really a lot more concerned about the character and the behavior than I am about the skill of the player. Another mm-hmm. huge element is that we seem to excuse kids that are good because we wouldn't want to hinder their progress by asking them to have to work on their character. Oh, no, that would be such a shame. So, you know, shame on those people.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Well, okay, let's move on to our next topic because I know you have other things you want to discuss with me today, and we're down to our last couple
minutes.
I think
we heard that one pretty good.
I think so, too. All right, so next.
Next up. All right, so Sterling Strother, who, you know, you had us on the show not too long ago, and we appreciate that. Last December, we created USA Tennis Coach LLC, and it's going swimmingly. We're just having a great time. And it's been a great time to help educate, certify, and mentor high school coaches. So one recent development is that we now have Scott Enge, who's the National High School Tennis Coaches Association Executive Director, is now a lifetime member of our organization. And he is also on our advisory board. We're a for-profit company, but we're assembling this advisory board so that we have people kind of looking out for us and keeping us pointed in the right direction. But that it's, you know, it's not a nonprofit board where we serve at their pleasure. So it's kind of a fun thing because we can listen to them and they have their input into the mission and objectives and whatnot. And yet, you know, we have full control to, you know, maintain our original mission as we see it. So we have our test ready, and if there are high school coaches that are interested in this, you know, basically what you do is you read The Art of Coaching High School Tennis, second edition, and then we have a 186-question test that is 70% softball questions, really easy, about 20% require some thinking, and 10 are brain twisters that make it so that nobody's going to get an easy A. So we're really excited about that, and we've already seen some really great feedback from coaches who read the book and who we've worked with to help them have a better coaching experience, have their teams have a better experience, because what we're trying to do is awake the sleeping giant of high school tennis in the United States.
You know me, I'm a huge proponent of high school tennis, and, you know, especially now that UTR is including high school tennis results, there's no reason that even the highest level juniors shouldn't be playing for their school teams and having that experience. I think it's phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, look, Jack Sock and Steve Johnson both played high school tennis.
Yep.
And, you know, one of the benefits that people don't realize is that, you know, if you go and play high school tennis and you are, you know, head and shoulders above everybody in your region –